Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com if you're online. This week, it's a Freemasons special. What Rupert Murdoch's Sky TV won't tell you in their so-called Inside Freemasonry series, which is going out at 8 p.m. every Monday at the moment. Is the series just an advert for Freemasonry? A critical review by a former senior Freemason. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, I'll give contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Ian Mattison, and I'm an ex-Freemason. I joined in 1973, and I left in the early 90s because I was forced to for circumstances which I won't go into at this particular stage. And in that meaning time as well, I became a devout Christian, which I felt was completely against the Masonic world that I was in previously.
Well, hang on, let's start there, Ian, because the Freemasons were very, very strongly will say that any someone who's part of any religion can be, whether it's Muslim, Jewish, or maybe even none, can all join Freemasons, and all are tolerated and accepted in the craft.
Of course, that's what they will say, and that's what's one of the messages that I've got. But I would say that it is, and in the actual the films that I've just been watching, one of the senior Masons describes it as a secular society. And if you look up the dictionary definition of a secular society, it has nothing to do with religion or faith. And yet within Masonry lodges, there are prayers said, there are lodge chaplains who invariably are ministers of the cloth. The term God is invoked. And in English lodges especially, the various oaths are taken on what they call the volume of the sacred law, which is in fact the Holy Bible.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, how can it be secular with all that stuff to do with God?
I absolutely agree with you, and it's one of the things, but that's the point. I wanted to look at this programme. I've seen other programmes about Freemasonry. I've read lots of books about Freemasons, from Freemasons and from ex-Freemasons, and it is at odds, and what I was hoping to see with this program Inside Freemasonry, which they declare they're going to lift the veil of secrecy, in their words, on the program, I was hoping that they actually then would do just that. But of course, once again, there's been the obfuscation. It doesn't show it at all, and you don't get any more idea of what's going on with the obligations of Freemasonry or their secrets, even despite the three programmes I've seen so far.
Okay, well, you know, one of the tricks of the media is you don't know what they're not telling you. So when you were watching it, what did you feel was not being shown, and what was missing from the Inside Freemasonry view they were giving us?
Well, they don't get, they say, lifting the veil of secrecy. Well, no, that would immediately tell you that they're actually going to reveal the secrets, which they don't. They go along with, they show a first degree ceremony up to a point where they close the doors and say, of course, the remainder of this ceremony must remain private. And they do that in a couple of the other episodes as well, which shows that they actually do not go there. What they actually do is give you a couple of sentences and a couple of words from some of the more benign and drama-led narrative, which actually makes no difference to the whole thing. But it gives you an idea that if this is what it's about, it seems very, very calm, benign. And to the outsider, thinking, oh, well, that seems okay.
Well, now, you've been through these initiation rituals, these rites, or whatever you want to call them. What for you were the difficult parts of it, or the things that they weren't showing us on Sky TV?
Well, the original obligation that one takes is quite frightening, quite sinister. Which you only find out afterwards, because, I mean, they do mention it very quickly. There's a mention of you actually have a blindfold in so that you don't see what's going on until you get in there. And one chap actually does say, and of course they place a noose around your neck, but then they don't deal with that anymore. they then go on to say, well, you have to bare your left breast to show you're not a woman, which is actually was rather amusing from my point of view, because that's never been told to me. And of course, if you want to check that out, you can go and see the co-Freemasonry people in Surbiton who admit men and women. And I can't really see a ceremony going along with a woman trying to show her left breast.
Now, I mean, all these things you're talking about, I mean, you're talking about a noose, a blindfold, you're talking about the bare breast. And actually, when they have the bare breast, there's also a point of a sharp knife put next to you. Now, this kind of comes across as a death threat. I mean, do you think when people go into rehearsing these rituals, get prepared for them, that they realise this is what's happening?
You don't. You are completely. And it states so in the thing that the candidate does not know what's going on until he gets in there. The better for him to realise what's happening when he get there. So you get prepared by somebody outside the lodge, where, as you say, your breast is bared, your left knee is made bare as well, and you're blindfolded. And once you bear a blindfold, a noose is placed around your neck. What actually happens is when you get inside the door, a sharp pointed dagger is placed against your left breast and taken away immediately. They quietly ask you, did you feel anything? And of course, if you do feel anything, then yes, you do say so. And only later on, when the blindfold is taken off, when you're more than halfway through your ceremony, is it explained to you as to why this happened. And I'm a reasonable ritualist myself at one time, so actually I can tell you that one of the explanations of the poignard, as it's called, is that to tell you that if I was decided that I wanted to find out about Freemasonry, and when the door opened, blindfold or not, I rushed in to see what was going on, then I would have been accessory to my own death by stabbing. And equally, if I then tried to escape, the mason holding the rope would have pulled it tight, and I would have been accessory to my own death by strangling. And this is only found out when you take the obligation a little bit further down the line. So, yes, it's only afterwards when you realise what you've said. Of course, you can't get out of that. It's like Hotel California. You know, you can check out any time you like, but you can never leave.
Sounds like the European Union.
I'm not sure.
Anyhow, look, what is the point of having a death threat? I mean, because that's what these various symbols effectively are. And I can imagine, I mean, I've seen bits of film myself of one ritual where the guy was actually trembling who was being initiated.
Absolutely. If you don't realise what you're going to... And if you were told beforehand, oh, by the way, when you go in, this is going to happen to you, you're going to be threatened with death if you... And the idea of death is that you will not reveal the secrets of Freemasonry ever in your life, ever again, etc. It's not like the old school board days when I cross my heart and hope to die sort of stuff. This is something fairly, you know, very, very real to you, because they want to preserve the secrets of Masonry. And you are then obligated to say you would rather suffer death than reveal those secrets. And that goes right through to the third degree. The third program that was on just last Monday deals with the third degree, and they say it is the most moving of all the ceremonies, etc. But what it actually does, besides dealing with the mythical life of a chap called Hiram Abiff, he died in the narrative. He died as a result of not giving up the secrets of Masonry to those who wanted it. And he would rather die than give them up. And that's exactly in the narrative what he did. And the third degree ceremony is to remind you of what he did, as to remind you not to do it yourself. So you are stuck with this sword of Damocles over your head of not giving away the secrets upon pain of death. And you would rather suffer death than give them out. Now, what sort of obligation is that? If you knew what it was going to be before you went in, would you go in?
Now, I know you were actually forced out of Freemasonry. Do you think that there has been changes in Freemasonry over the last, say, 40 or 50 years? Because for a long time, people felt it was something quite good, a kind of speakeasy place where you could go in and speak your mind, where it might be difficult to do that outside. Have you seen a kind of change in Freemasonry in your lifetime?
Well, as I left, as I was saying, you're quite right. I've been out of the thing 20 odd years or so. And there are bound to be some changes within it. Even there were changes even within my lifetime whilst in it. Because when I took the obligation, the wording of the obligation to be killed in various ways agreed upon was very much a part of the ritual. But it was changed, I believe, in the 1980s to actually say, here's the penalty. However, there is a more traditional penalty. And the traditional penalty, or the more relevant penalty, is probably even worse, in my opinion, than dying.
Well, how do you mean? I mean, what can be worse than that?
Exactly. And this is what I thought. And when I'd left it all, and when I sat down for some quiet times, then I really did think, you know, what is worse? Because the obligation says to you, if you don't die, here's a, and I'll quote, a more effective penalty of being a perjured individual, void of all moral worth, and totally unfit to be a member of any society who prize honour and virtue above the external advantages of rank and fortune. In other words, it's a living hell.
It's be like it's almost being shunned by all your friends and yeah, close people are, who are close to you.
I've met it in the last few years when people have either found out I'm a Mason or discovered or thought I might be, or in fact there was one chap who actually sat in a public restaurant and was chatting to me. I'd known him for about a year or so, and said to me, "Oh, you'd make a good Mason. Why don't you join?" And I thought it was quite funny for him to ask me that. He then tried to proceed to tell me the various handshakes and bits and pieces to do with it, which I thought was quite amusing. But technically, he's not supposed to do that, or even really not. But I believe later on, he might have made some inquiries through lodge systems. And if you make an inquiry through the lodge system, you can easily find out whether I've been excluded, resigned, left, whatever. And from that moment onwards, I found out from him that he did not want to know me ever more. He sent an email to somebody saying, "I never want to work with this man ever again," etc. And I believe that that was some his colleagues, etc., who were in his particular lodge, had either found out somehow. And certainly from being a very good friend for a couple of years and really helped him out and he helped me out, suddenly I was cut off and, as you say, completely, you know, didn't want to know me at all.
Well, you've touched on an area there of sort of doubt and possible paranoia and conspiracy theory. I mean, a lot of people say, "Oh, well, the Masons are out to get me." How do you know if they really are? Because they may be.
And because of that, to me, in my mind, is that obligation. Yes, I might be being paranoid. I've been very fortunate in even outside Freemasonry and left it alone. I've been fortunate is that I picked up my career from the ground upwards again, and I've had a pretty good career in the last sort of 20-25 years or so. But always I have been wary of the Freemasons who I've come across. And of course, being an ex-Freemason myself, I can recognise and know who a Freemasons are, and I can take steps to avoid being associated with them. But I recognise them. They're not, these days, they're not so, not so closed. They're rather more open about their membership, etc., than it was, say 30 years ago, when it was quite exclusive.
Okay, well, back to this programme. What else have you noticed about that, you know, to make as part of your review?
Well, they pride themselves on, they said that they're a very good charitable society. They've got fantastic. There's the Grand Masonic Charity, and therefore, and there was people on the program sort of preening away, saying what a lovely group we are. We raise money every year. They quoted that they raised $20 million in 2015, and $5 million went to non-Masonic charities, and making themselves out to be that there now. There's lots of other charitable institutions, every bit as good as them, so they're no different. And why in the program like this would they need to make themselves to be sort of so much better than any of the others? Because that's what they're saying. Yeah. However, what I actually will tell you is that within the lodge, when you pay your annual dues or your membership fees, like I don't know how many clubs you may belong to, tennis club or cricket or whatever, you pay a membership fee, and as long as you pay your membership fee, you're in it. And within the membership fee of a lodge member, within his obligatory fees, which he's got to pay every year, there are contributions are taken out of those fees towards local, provincial, and the Grand Charity. So automatically, I'm making a payment to charity through my dues. So that's no wonder that the charities are raised. Okay, there's other events going on, like fundraising events and dinners and things like that. But generally, through the dues, one is paying an obligatory amount of money to charity. And in my opinion, if I want to give to charity, that's purely my voluntary contribution. That's what I want to pay if I wish to support any particular one. In this way, they ensure that their charity is always funded by the members. And I just think that's not quite how I would like to go about doing it.
Well, it doesn't sound quite like charity, does it? Charity is a sort of voluntary gift, and this seems like it's a sort of slice of your membership, which is definitely got to go to that charity. It doesn't sound very voluntary to me. Also, Ian, I mean, I have to ask, you know, you as a former Freemason, seeing this programme, is there anything, I mean, say you were Rupert Murdoch commissioning this programme for Sky, you know, what sort of demands would you be making about what should be in there?
Well, if I think that, I mean, it depends, actually, if whoever's commissioning the programme, is that person a Freemason? Because if I commission a programme as a Freemason, I would want the programme to make my organisation appear very benign and worth joining and appeal to lots of people. So I would leave out a lot of the secrets and obligations and other things which are hidden within the thing that would make people think twice about joining. And all the programmes I've seen so far have been just that. So my first thought is this being commissioned by a Freemason or not? If it wasn't commissioned by a Freemason, or if I was to commission one, then I would like to see everything open and above. All the obligations open, if it's okay for people to say they are an honourable society, ancient and honourable, as they say, then why not show everything and then let the people decide? So there's no balanced view. These programmes so far seem to be quite a good advert for joining Freemasonry.
Maybe it is an advert. Maybe they should be paying rather than Rupert Murdoch paying them. Also, I mean, one of the things that quite controversially is used is a human skull, I understand, in some of the initiations. Have they shown that on this programme so far?
Yeah, they show a human skull, and the human skull, and the skull and crossbones is shown in the third degree ceremony, because it's all to do. And there's a sort of a makeshift grave, or in some lodges, there's an actual coffin for the body to be lowered into. That's you, the candidate, the body. And this is to reflect on your mortality. As we say, the story of Hiram Abiff, the chap who's the architect of the thing, well, actually, it shows. And you enact out the killing of him and then the raising of him afterwards. Back to life. Well, actually, he doesn't come back to life. He raises you up, and from the way he's raised up, are the third degree secrets are then revealed to a master mason. But they're purely parts of mortality, as you and I would see. You've seen skull and crossbones on pirate ships, you've seen skull and crossbones in churches, etc.
Well, hang on a minute, because also the skull and crossbones were on the peaks of the caps of all the SS Nazis in the Second World War. It's also a symbol involved in black magic too. I mean, it does seem as if there is a bit of a negative connotation to this, and yet the Masons seem to embrace it.
Yeah, they want to embrace it, yes. But, I mean, one of the things about the Masons is that, I mean, again, go back to the first degree. When you're given your obligation, you're given a what's known as a sign, a token, and a word. And the sign is given, and I don't know if you want to do the gesture, but if you open your right hand and stick your left thumb out at right angles to it, and then draw it across your throat from your left ear to your right ear, and then bring it down to your side, that is the token of a Mason, first degree, although it's always the basic one. And it's symbolic of you having your throat cut across, because that's what you agree should happen to you if you give up the secrets of Freemasonry. The token, as they say, or the handshake, as everybody knows, is a particular one. As in first degree, you'll press the knuckle of the first finger of the other guy's hand and so on and so forth. And the word, which is a token of word, is taken straight from the Holy Bible. There's nothing, there's no extra words here and there thought up or whatever. They're taken straight out of the Holy Bible, as is the Fellowcraft is taken the story of the building of King Solomon's temple. And here we are now back within taking stories out of the Holy Bible or the Christian Bible or whatever you want to call it. And yet it's applied to what they've called. And in the program, they says we are a secular society. Bit of odds there, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, yes. Anyway, so we'll have a few more of these episodes. Ian, the other thing, of course, is when someone is a Freemason and you meet them as an ex-Mason, is it actually easy for you to suss out that there's another Mason there?
20 years ago, I would probably say be a bit more difficult. The Masons at the time, 20, 30 years ago, were rather more circumspect. They never really... Today... With programs like this one going out, people where certainly if you go from German Freemasonry that coming back over here, there is the English speaking Freemasons in Germany, etc. So if you see somebody wearing certainly a man wearing a little forget me not badge in his left lapel, he's probably a Mason. Also, there's other people who actually and they're not discreet amongst each other when they talk, and you only need to listen to them. The way they talk and some of the ritual, some of the comments and the ritual comes out from them.
Now, listen, I mean, I overheard a conversation with the chair of planning back in the 1990s at Bristol City Council. It was at a public meeting and some developer was giving him a bit of a jip and hassle about, are you going to give me planning permission next week? And he said, well, let's not talk about it now. Let's talk about it on the level. Now, I may be a bit of a conspiracy theorist, a bit paranoid, thinking that may have been some Masonic code. What do you think?
Well, it could be, because there's various things that somebody could say, oh, well, let's go and meet on the square. We'll meet on the level somewhere. And they'll make some sort of comment to each other to then see if each other is a Mason. If they are Masons, if they do suspect, so if I suspected somebody was a Mason, and even today if I suspected somebody, I could within a few seconds and a few comments here and there find out whether he was indeed a lodge member.
Okay, so there's a kind of code, isn't it? It's a sort of secret code, really.
It's not so much secret, it's if you know the language. I mean, if you were a Shakespeare buff, and walked into a room of non-Shakespeare buffs, except one, you could quote, a few couplets from Hamlet or one of the sonnets, and you'd sooner or later he would suddenly realise, oh, you're quoting Shakespeare, I'm a Shakespeare buff, and go and meet you. It's the same sort of thing. There's ritual in there that you can do. I don't know if you want me to give you an example.
Yeah.
But I did. I was... in one of my last military units, and there were four or five chaps who all came out into the little foyer. I was duty officer at the time, but they'd all gathered for their evening. They were going somewhere for the evening. They were all in blazers and little forget-me-not on their lapels. And one of them was talking about the types of pillar that you've got in the unit there, in some various buildings in London, what types of columns they are, what architecture columns they are. And they just turned around to me and said, well, what columns do you think they are? Now, I suspected that they were off to a Masonic meeting. So I actually just turned around and said to them, well, you know, the type of architecture could either be Doric or, I think, Corinthian composite or Roman. Now, that's the exact order that you use in one of the rituals in Freemasonry, in one of the degree ceremonies, when you talk to somebody. And, of course, immediately somebody picked that up. Why did I say it in that order? I said, well, that's just the order I thought of. You know, I'm a whiz kid on architecture. But he could see him is sort of, oh, hold on a minute, was that suspicious? Now, I knew from that moment, yes, that's where they were going. Into some meeting or other.
And now, I mean, another thing is there are different types of, there's things like the Royal Arch, there's things like Mark Masonry, Royal Arc, Mariners. There's lots of different branches once you've gone through your kind of initial 3 degrees. What do you make of all those, and have they explained any of that in this so-called Inside Freemasonry program on Sky on Monday evenings?
Not so far. All they've dealt with is the initiation ceremony of a new Mason. But they've also then showed some provincial meeting and some meeting to do with the quarterly communication of Grand Lodge. And believe you me, I've been able to attend only one quarterly communication of Grand Lodge in my whole lifetime as a Freemason, and that was 20-odd years before it finished. You don't get to go to these meetings, so why they show them on this program to give people an idea that you can get up there is nobody's business.
Well, I suppose it's the idea is to get people enthusiastic. It sounds again like it's a bit of an advert.
Yeah, it's very much. I don't know if they're going to on the next to deal with the next sets up. I was a member of the Holy, it was called Chapter Lodge, which is the Holy Royal Arch Chapter of Jerusalem, to give it its full title. Mark Masonry is an offshoot from the Second Degree, and it's a different offshoot. There are different rituals that you will have. They haven't mentioned at all in this program. There's the Scottish Rite, there's the Emulation Rite, there's the Swedish Rite, etc. And I've been in Freemasonry lodges in both UK and Germany. I've attended German-speaking lodges as well as English-speaking lodges. And for also a society that prides itself on being a brotherhood, and you call yourself brother, therefore you're equal, no matter, even though you've got a Masonic rank, that also does not gel at all with my experience. It's not equal. There are lodges dedicated to schools, colleges, regiments, and even ethnic groups. There's a lodge in London that's purely for Jewish Masons only. But also there's a lodge in Germany called Freimaurischer Order, which actually does not admit Jews.
Oh, right. So if you're Jewish, you can't join that lot.
Absolutely.
What do you make of these different branches then? I mean, what's the point of having a completely different branch of Freemasonry?
One of the things, even as a young boy or whatever it is, that we all used to know, if we knew a secret against somebody, didn't we? If we knew a secret and others didn't, we were like one up, weren't we? We were one up the step. And this is sort of gone into the adult version. When you first go into Freemasonry, you get your first degree, you get the secrets of that degree, and you're told there's the next one up. There's the next one up. And that's all this extension is the next one up.
It almost sounds like it's an infinite number of different secrets that you've got to then try and attain.
Yes, absolutely. You've got it just in one. It's attaining those degrees, attaining those levels in which you want to achieve. The higher up, you more you achieve those levels, the better the Mason you're supposed to be. And of course, you will get then promoted within rank, and you will be able to wear lots of fancy and nice regalia, which is shown on one of the episodes. There's a very large provincial grand meeting in Bolton Wanderers Football Club, in which this whole province has a very big ladies' night, but they all attend the ladies' night in their full regalia. And I've never seen that before. I've never been to a ladies' night where I've worn my regalia. It's normally just going into a hotel somewhere. It's like a dinner dance with your ladies, and you just have to be lodge members. But in this one, everybody's wearing their regalia to show what rank they are. And it's quite sad to see that in this meeting is a young man who's a fellow craft Freemason, and he's a second degree, and he wears a sort of fairly plain white apron with two little blue rosettes on them. And he does say in the program that at this meeting he felt sort of quite humble, that there was all these people, all this fancy regalia, and he felt a little bit humble because of his fairly plain one. And I maintain, as I watched it, my thoughts to myself were, well, all these people are wandering around looking good, showing their rank, and it's meant to be that way. And if he felt a little bit underwhelmed by it all and not quite fitting at the time, that he was meant to.
Well, that's right. I mean, I suppose, and also to encourage him to, climb the ladder, as they say. Also, I mean, how many degrees are there? Each degree is a different ritual. How many altogether?
Well, you can go up, it's mainly in the US, etc., that then there's people, I've met them and I've seen their business cards we're on the top right-hand corner. You've got 33 and a degree sign at the top, the little circle. And the 33rd degree Mason is supposed to be the highest. But I'm sure that when you get, if when you get to 33 degrees, I'm sure somebody will turn around and say, oh, by the way, here's another one.
Also, I mean, you yourself were in the military. Are there any areas of public life or business or wherever? I mean, you mentioned the church too. I'm assuming that's the Church of England, not necessarily Catholics. Or, you know, are there any areas that where you think that Freemasons are particularly, there are quite a lot of Masons in that profession?
Well, there's a lot of Masons in the army. There's lots of army lodges formed years ago. And there's lots of, as you say, there are lots of other military lodges as well. There's naval ones, etc. And, I mean, of course, over a number of years, I haven't heard anything over the last 20 years of various papal bulls from the Pope condemning Freemasonry. And, in fact, at one stage, excommunicating Freemasons who are Catholics. And I don't know if that's been rescinded or not, but I suspect not. It's still there. So, and also, I mean, I attended a lodge in Germany at one stage where the director of ceremonies himself was a Muslim, and on the same pedestal as the Holy Bible for the more Christian type of entering Freemason. Next to him was the Quran, in case there was a member who came in from Islam, and he would have to give his obligation on the Quran.
Now, the other thing here is, I mean, I can remember going to visit the Masonic halls here in Bristol. They didn't want to call it a temple, but it certainly was a temple when you go in there. Yeah. They had two there. There's one which has got the kind of checkerboard carpet and various columns. Then there was what they called a Royal Arch Temple. And it was all completely no windows, and they conduct ceremonies just with the light of one candle. But the thing that struck me was that one of the guys who was there just as a kind of gopher was one of the chief magistrates in Bristol. And it does bother me that potentially you've got sort of, you know, a rank of somebody could be much higher in Freemasonry, and they could be within Freemasonry actually telling what the people who, you know, the outside society think are the most important. They could be telling them what to do. What do you make of this whole idea of rank inside and outside Masonry?
And once you're in Masonry, it doesn't matter really where you've come from or what happens. Yes, you will be you could rise to the rank of a worshipful master and be the head of the particular lodge. And to the left and right of you, let's say the military, I could have been a captain as a worshipful master. Whereas to the left and right of me are wardens who are, one's a colonel, one's a brigadier. There are, as you say, in other walks of life, somebody could be a judge, etc. But that only applies within the lodge, or supposed to be. And quite often, it has been, once you go out the lodge, take off your lodge regalia, etc., one is then usually reminded in quite no uncertain terms by those of higher station in life that, by the way, you're only senior to me once you're in there. Once you come out, I'm now brigadier, I'm now judge, I'm now head policeman, etc. You're reminded quite sternly that your place only is ranked within the lodge is once the meeting is started. So, you know, there is different ways of doing it. Within the army, I certainly know that they would not, and they have made sure that there no lance corporal makes it to worshipful master while there's a few officers present, etc. No.
And what are the roles of the wardens? Because we've got here in Bristol, we've got this Society of Merchant Venturers who were the families formed that, who were behind the trip of John Cabot in 1497, I think it was, discovered North America and Newfoundland and a couple of trips, and then sent a whole load of people afterwards who were really responsible for genocide of the Native Americans afterwards. But the Society of Merchant Venturers, they have a master, they have a senior warden who will be the master next year, and they also have a junior warden who's going to be the master in 2 years' time as part of the Merchant Venturers. So I wonder, does that actually reflect what goes on within Freemasonry as well, and what's the role of the wardens and the master?
Oh, very much. You know, as you say, it's create a hierarchy. The Freemasonry isn't sort of didn't start off brand new. It copied a lot of things from a lot of areas, and so a master is like the head of the team. The junior and senior wardens are basically his deputies, and they will have certain duties within their areas. Like the master sits in a chair in basically the east end of what the lodge is. The senior warden is at the west. And the junior warden is in the south, and so they have little areas to look after. They have little duties to perform within the ritual, but basically it's just a hierarchy of way of producing your little cabal of who's in charge within the lodge. The mercerial master first, the junior wardens, then you have deacons, people who lead people around, and then you will have various people further down the rank before your general master mason sits around with the other masons, the new ones, etc., and the past masters, the old and bold, the people who've been through it, will sit at the top end and look down their glasses at you to make sure you young people get it right, and they look over at you like sort of just looking over to make sure that it all works. There's no great secret to the fact that, I mean, it's other, as you say, other societies, open and above board societies that you might know, will have the same sort of hierarchy.
Well, I can't say that the merchant venturers are open and above board. They're extremely secretive. I mean, for example, they're constituted under a royal charter, so they don't have to file any accounts at Companies House or anything like that. So nobody really knows how much money they've got, much shareholdings, investments and that sort of thing, bearer bonds. They could have foreign investments in tax havens, absolutely, Swiss bank accounts. Nobody knows what they've got, you know, and they've been there for hundreds of years.
There are other societies like the ancient antediluvian order of the buffaloes. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're quite an open bunch, but their lodges are formed around the same thing: wardens, masters, etc. So it's just a form of hierarchy. They've got special duties to perform within the ritual, within a particular degree, ritual ceremonies. The junior warden might take the lead in some of it, and the senior warden some other times, etc., to share the load with the master of what's going on. And eventually one of the wardens will become the master of a lodge. And one of the conditions of being a master is that you have to have served in the office of warden at least once in your career.
Does the warden have any kind of duties or jobs outside the lodge? Or, I mean, you know, when the lodge isn't actually meeting?
Not really. The main once the lodge is finished and when it gets to the main workload, it is devolved upon the secretary, the treasurer, and the master. But the master will call together his wardens as a committee when they have new members to vet.
Oh, okay. And what about when you start to do something to upset the master of the lodge? Is it likely that you might get a knock on the door?
It can happen, yeah. And telephone calls, etc. Yes, if you're not particularly good at what you've done, or if you've had a time where you haven't learned the ritual very well, etc., then yes, a quiet word in the corner or a visit by the one of the senior brethren of the lodge, yes, could well come around and visit you, talk to you, meet you somewhere for a drink, and persuade you to do a little better, shall we say.
Yes, I want to have a word with you about X, Y, Z. Anyway, also, I mean, we've got a couple of weeks of this to go. Is there anything you're really hoping that they do put in these last few episodes to give this series a little bit of credibility that means it's not just a kind of cheap advert for joining Freemasonry, which does suggest maybe that the Freemasons are a little bit desperate for members?
Well, I think when you say that last desperate for members, I mean, if you do go and have a look at it all, when you have a look at these ceremonies, and I'm not sure whether they are genuine ceremonies or they've been stage managed for the film, because a lot of them, if you have a look at them, there's actually not many people attending the lodge. There is one chap who is becoming a master of a lodge after about 5 years only of being in Freemasonry. Now, it took me 20 years to actually get up to becoming a master of a lodge. That's because I moved around, etc. but I didn't feel as though I had any experience to do that earlier than that particular time. And if you take it, the fact that you would normally spend 1 year in one of the positions, then if after 4 or 5 years you're suddenly finding yourself to be master of a lodge, that also suggests to me that perhaps the membership isn't quite as large as it should be. And maybe, I don't know, I'm not looking for anything in these next two episodes beyond craft masonry, and I don't see that they're going to. But certainly if they haven't shown any of these secrets, and they do say so on the programmes, you know, the door is closed now and the rest of the ceremony must remain private, and then the door closes and then, you know, cut the film, and then the next thing the door opens and everybody says well done and to everybody else. I don't see that's going to change in these next two episodes, but I look forward to seeing them so I can get an overall view of the whole thing. But at the moment, it seems to be, you're quite right, perhaps it's a bit of an advert for it.
It's also been pegged on this whole thing of it's 300 years since the beginning of Freemasonry. What are your thoughts? I mean, most people, I think, at least most of the books on Freemasonry, like The Brotherhood by, I'm not sure he wrote that, but anyway, Martin Short as well, Inside the Brotherhood, say that there was something very similar to Freemasonry a lot around long before that. What's your thoughts on that particular issue of, is it really 300 years since this craft suddenly appeared out of nowhere?
Well, actually, in 1717, I studied the history of it all as well once I got into it. And in 1717, various members of sort of lodges that met locally or met in areas decided to get together, and there were two sections of them, and they separated for quite a number of years before they came together to be the United Grand Lodge of England. One group met in one of the pubs in London, and another group met in another pub in London, but eventually they came together. But to start with, it was quite disjointed. Freemasonry is taking its lead, but going right back to 1717, because that's when the earliest details appear. But for 30, 40, maybe 50 years or so, it was quite disjointed. It even got to the stage where the governments of the day were thinking of proscribing Freemasonry, because they thought it wasn't actually all as benign as it was meant to be, and there were various conspiracies sought to emulate from.
Now, I mean, one of the things we've heard is that Hitler, one of the things that the Nazis did was actually ban Freemasonry. Is that true?
There is. I think, you know, I've certainly read and know that yes, they were one of the prosecuted sections of society that Hitler wanted to banish. And I believe there was people going to, went to the gas chambers and went to the concentration camps of various ethnic groups, etc. One of which were Masons. Yes, that is what I believe, and that's what I've read. So I would tend to believe that yes, he did that. However, if you look then at the history of what Goebbels was trying to do at Wewelsburg, in the castle in southern Germany, I don't know if you've ever been or know of that background, where he was trying to get the Aryan race together. And if you go, I've seen a program where it shows the inner workings of Wewelsburg down in the cellars of there, where he was trying to get this thing together. It looked very much like the similar type of checkered floor, etc., when various ornaments around the area.
Well, you know what you're suggesting there is that the Nazis had their own kind of version of Freemasonry, and anyone that was outside it that was would possibly be a threat.
You would not be wrong in thinking that if you saw what I saw at what was going on at Wewelsburg, yeah.
So what was going on there?
Well, that was where Goebbels wanted to set up his headquarters afterwards. It's a very distinctive castle. I'm going to let the English have a look, because it's like in a triangle form, with sort of round towers on the apexes of the triangles, and it's quite a sort of distinctive place. And I didn't get too much of a glance of the whole, you know, taking the whole program. It was part of another program what they were trying to do, but certainly Goebbels wanted to establish back this famous Aryan race going right going its history right back into the realms of what was previously Prussia and the old German way. That's what he was trying to do. That's how my history, you know, I could be, I could sit here and be, told I was not quite on the right thing, but that's what I've read so far.
Okay, well, anyway, Ian, fascinating to hear from you. And I'll tell you what we'll do is when the series is finished, we'll ask you, if you don't mind, to do another, maybe shorter review, telling us, giving us the whole picture, because I find it rather irritating when we're supposed to be getting some sort of investigative journalism, and actually all we're really getting is an advert by the people who are supposed to be being investigated. It sounds like rather an insult, and I really appreciate you coming on to give us some of your insight as a former Freemason yourself.
Yeah, thanks very much, Tony. As I say, what I gained from this lot is that, and I've spoken to you before, of one of the things that, in order to produce a balance, if they want to really know what's going on, then they ought to speak to somebody who can tell them what's going on, and perhaps they ought to put that on film and then give the idea of people. Then they can make up their minds properly. At the moment, as you say, they're being given the nicer side, the pleasant side of a society that loads of societies like that around, no different. But they have one difference, of course, is that Freemasons consider themselves much better than us mere mortals. And they're told that, and I was told that at my initiation, when I was given the token or grip of a Freemason, and I could use it to distinguish a Mason, and I would also be distinguished from the rest of the world. I was made to be very proud that I was now up above, above the normal run of the mill human being outside of Freemasonry.
I mean, is it stretching a point to say a master race?
It might be stretching a point to do that. Other people would think that, but all I can say is that little bit of pride that is instilled in you to say that you're now much better than the average human out there, and anybody who's not a Mason is not a very good person anyway, is certainly promulgated within Freemasonry. And you're made to feel as though you're rather a special human being because you know all the moral duties, you're an upright, stand-up, worthy person, etc., with the inference being that others who aren't in Masonry have a deficiency in these areas in their lives.
Well, they call them the profane, don't they? And I've got some news for them. Everyone's special.
Absolutely.
And we'll speak to you in a few weeks' time, I hope.
Thanks so much, Tony.
Gentlemen, we have two basic suggestions for the design of this residential block. And I thought it best that the architects themselves came in to explain the advantages of both designs. That must be the first architect now. Ah, yes, it's Mr. Wiggin of Ironside and Malone.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is a 12-storey block combining classical Neo-Georgian features with all the advantages of modern design. The tenants arrive in the entrance hall here, are carried along the corridor on a conveyor belt in extreme comfort and past murals depicting Mediterranean scenes towards the rotating knives. The last 20 feet of the corridor are heavily soundproof. The blood pours down these chutes and the mangled flesh slurps into these large...
Excuse me.
Hmm?
Did you say knives?
Rotating knives, yes.
Are you proposing to slaughter our tenants?
Does that not fit in with your plans?
No, we wanted a simple block of flats.
Ah, I see. I hadn't correctly divined your attitude towards your tenants. You see, I mainly design slaughterhouses. Yes, it is. Mind you, this is a real beaut. I mean, none of your blood caked on the walls and flesh flying out of the windows inconveniencing passers-by with this one. I mean, my life has been building up to this.
Yes, and well done. But we did want a block of flats.
Well, may I ask you to reconsider? I mean, you wouldn't regret it. Think of the tourist trade.
No, it's just that we wanted a block of flats and not an abattoir.
Yes, but of course that's just the sort of blinkered Philistine pig ignorance I've come to expect from you. Not creative garbage. You sit there on your loathsome spotty behind, squeezing blackheads, not caring a tinker's cuss about the struggling artist. You excrement! You lousy, hypocritical, whining toadies! With your lousy coloured TV sets and your Tony Jackson golf clubs and your bleeding Masonic handshakes, you wouldn't let me join with you, you black, balling ass. Well, I wouldn't become a Freemason now if you went down!
Well, we're sorry you feel like that, but we did want a block of flats. Nice though the abattoir is.
Oh, the abattoir, that's not important. But if one of you could put in a word for me, I'd love to be a Freemason. Freemasonry opens doors. I mean, I was a bit on edge just now, but if I was a Mason, I'd just sit at the back and not get in anyone's way.
Thank you.
I've got a second-hand apron.
Thank you.
I nearly got in at Hendon.
Thank you.
I'm sorry about that, gentlemen. The second architect is Mr. Levy of Wymas and Dibble.
Oh. Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning. This is a scale model of the block. There are 28 stories with 280 modern apartments. There are 3 main lifts and 2 service lifts. Access would be from Dibbingley Road. The structure is built on a central pillar system with cantilevered floors in pre-stressed steel and concrete. The dividing walls on each floor section are fixed with recessed magnalium flange group. By avoiding wood and timber derivatives and all other inflammables, we've almost totally removed the risk of... Quite frankly, I think the central pillar system may need strengthening a bit.
Yeah, isn't that going to put the cost up?
It might.
Well, I don't know whether I'd worry about strengthening that much. After all, they're not meant to be luxury flats.
No, I quite agree. I mean, provided the tenants are of light build and relatively sedentary, and given a spot of good weather, I think we're on to a winner here. Yes.
Oh, thank you.
quite agree.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It opens doors, I'm telling you.
Let's have a look at that handshake again in slow motion.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, Ian Matteson, former Freemason, reviewing Rupert Murdoch's Sky TV series, Inside Freemasonry, which is on every Monday at the moment at 8 p.m. A critical review, I think you'll agree. Also, thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or online at prsc.org.uk. Or you can go through the volunteering websites. That's Volunteering Bristol, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the national volunteering website do-it.org. And I hear that Volunteering Bristol will be closing down soon, having had its funding pulled. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So till the same time next week, goodbye for now.